Everybody get moved. I don't care who it is. Let's go. Give me everything you got.
Play fast, play hard. Let's beat these boys tonight in their house.
It's party time. It's party time.
Dad, here we go.
Touchdown.
Welcome into another week of the Eagle Eye in the Sky football podcast. I'm your host, Fran Duffy. Thank you for joining us here on PhiladelphiaEagles.com. It's week 9. The Eagles are 5-2 after 7 games. Obviously, a tough loss out there in the desert against the Arizona Cardinals. Just a really impressive team from top to bottom. It was a great game. I was glad to be in attendance there on the sideline. Obviously, a tough loss for the Eagles, but luckily, I've got NFL Film senior producer Greg Cosell here in studio this week to help me break that game down. We'll look forward to the Houston Texans, and then I'm going to talk later to one of my favorite guys in the business, NFL draft analyst from DraftInsider.net, Tony Pauline. We'll talk about some of these rumored underclassmen declarations for the upcoming NFL draft. We'll see who are some of the hot names that may or may not be coming out right now. But first, Greg, welcome to the show.
Fran, good to be with you. I hope you enjoyed yourself in the desert.
It was beautiful. I mean, I think that this will be a great venue for the Super Bowl compared to, obviously, New York is great. And
We knew that there were
lots of issues, but this will be a great venue.
It's a good venue. I've been, and it's great to be in Scottsdale, Tempe, Phoenix. You know, there's worse places to be in the beginning of February.
Yeah, and look, I mean, we landed, and it was 94 degrees. We got off the plane, and it was nice.
Did you have your horse with no name?
I did not have my horse with no name, although I did get back on the plane after the game. I was in shorts and short sleeves because, you know, we just got back from the stadium. It was right after the game. I got off the plane in Philly, and it was in the low 40s coming off the plane at 3 in the morning, and I was not too happy.
No. I imagine you weren't.
Yeah.
And that's always fun when you come back from the Super Bowl in February.
Yeah, yes. I can imagine.
Yes.
All right, Greg, so let's get to this game. Obviously, look, a game like this, there's a ton of what ifs, a lot of plays where the players and the coaches can go back and kind of question, oh, well, what if we had done this differently, or if I had made this tackle or made this call, or, you know, completed this pass or broke this tackle, you know, the game may have spun differently. I guess initially, what were some of the first things that stood out to you?
Let me look at the bigger picture, because, you know, a game like that, you hit it right on the head. We could spend forever talking about individual plays here and there.
Right.
And we might get to a few of those, but let's look at the bigger picture. Number one, I thought the defense on the whole continued to play well. They got burned on a cover zero blitz when Carson Palmer, I almost felt that the Cardinals baited that blitz and had a play set up perfectly for the cover zero blitz.
Yep.
Obviously, the winning touchdown to John Brown, which I think a number of players really should get responsibility for that and not just Nate Allen. But other than that, and again, we know they lost the game, and the John Brown play was key. But I thought that the defense continued to play well.
You take those two plays out, they gave up 245 yards of offense. And obviously, those two plays do count.
Right, they do count. But it's big picture. This is now a defense that I'm starting to feel anyway that you can count on for a pretty solid performance on a week-to-week basis.
I agree. Absolutely. 100%. And it's funny because I think nationally, especially in the world of, you know, fantasy football and stats and things like that, where, you know, we're kind of at right now, I don't think that's the case. But this is obviously a defense that's come a long way from where it's been in the last few years, and they're playing at a really high level.
And this is from film study, you know, not perception, not how people talk about them. It's from watching the tape. Offensively, they ran 88 plays, and they put up over 500 yards. So if you just pick up a box score or you see it on a TV screen, it looked like a big-time offensive performance. I would argue that their offense has still this year not found a real rhythm. As we take a long view with the key part of the season now coming up with Dallas having lost on Monday night, and obviously the division totally up for grabs, and quite frankly, the NFC totally up for grabs, I think as you look at the big picture, there's still something not quite right about this offense. And again, there's probably a number of reasons for that. The run game has not been as committed or as consistent as a year ago for a number of reasons, which you and I have discussed over the course of these podcasts. The passing game has been very erratic, inconsistent, even hit or miss. There's been times Nick Foles has looked very good. There's been other times Nick Foles has not looked good at all. There's just not been a rhythm that we saw last year to either the run game or the pass game. And at some point, you'd like to see that change. I think it will have to change, or we may be having more discussions like this after a tough loss against good teams.
Well, hopefully, obviously, over the next couple of weeks, you hope to have back Jason Kelce. You hope to have back Evan Mathis. Darren Sproles, hopefully, as well, will be back in the mix. So you would hope with those three guys back in the fold on the offensive side of the ball, things would start to turn a corner.
And this game was unlike most Eagle games in the Chip Kelly era of a year and a half. They were way out of whack with their balance in a game that was close. There was no reason to be so pass heavy. I can intellectually understand it. Patrick Peterson goes out. You might feel that's our best way to attack. But I'm not sure that Chip's offense, and in fact, I know Chip's offense is not necessarily built on such an imbalance in their pass-to-run ratio.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting because being on the sidelines at the game, and especially for those who have never, like, you know, shot a football game or have never had to be on that side, on the other side of the lens, when you're shooting the game, you're so focused on what you're doing, and you don't really know whether this run went for 2 yards or if it went for 8 yards or if it went for 15 yards. So it was very tough to kind of follow the flow of the game, especially because of the job that the Philly fan, I mean, the amount of Eagles fans that were in the building. After any play, there was cheering, and you didn't know if it was the Cardinals fans cheering or if it was the Eagles fans cheering. So just based on my sense of being at the game, I thought that, you know, that they had some issues moving the ball on the ground. Based on the fact, look, this was the number one run defense going into the league, or going into the game, I expected, look, watching the tape, that they were going to have some issues. I was very impressed with how they moved the ball on the ground, so I could see what you're saying. You know, I was kind of surprised that they didn't run the ball more.
No, I thought they had some success. I mean, this wasn't a game where they were shut down.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, like the San Francisco game, for instance, they had trouble moving the. I mean, they couldn't move the line of scrimmage in that game. And this game, look, they got some movement on Calais Campbell and on Dan Williams and those guys. They were able to move the ball, but like you said, look. Patrick Peterson going out, the issues that they have had in pass coverage this year, they've allowed a great number of yards. So you can understand that aspect.
And again, I've studied the Cardinals basically since Bruce Arians and Todd Bowles have been there. I've probably seen every game on tape. And the one thing you can be pretty certain of is Todd Bowles is going to blitz. Now, he didn't start the game high-percentage blitz, but it increased as the game went on. And I think when you're playing a defense like that, yes, their O-line, Mole, Tobin, they played better, and they played better each and every game. But still, it's hard to throw the ball that many times against a high-frequency blitz defense. There's just too many plays that are hard. It's earned yards if you're going to make plays, and it's hard. And look, they blitzed. They went cover zero blitz, I think, on 3 or 4 plays on the final drive.
Yeah, they were the final drive. They really came after them.
They really did.
I was very impressed after watching the tape. The job LeSean McCoy did in pass protection. Obviously, you know, he wasn't kept in every play. You know, obviously he was sent out on pass routes. But the job that he did numerous times on those AAA gap blitzes,
he had to,
where he took 2-for-1.
Yeah,
that's what you need to do. He did a really, really good job. He did it once on the final drive, actually.
Yep.
And overall, I mean, I could see the plays in my mind's eye where Matt Tobin slides and he, you know, helps pick up one of those interior rushers. David Mulk was sliding off and picking up one of those interior rushers. So, overall, obviously, you know, the Cardinals did get some of those plays, but I thought overall they did a pretty good job picking up the blitz.
Yeah, but you just look. I don't think Chip Kelly goes into any game wanting Nick Foles to drop back 62 times.
Yeah.
And, of course, he wasn't sacked, but he was under pressure a lot. And that's too many throws for any quarterback in any NFL game.
Yeah, no question about it. And, obviously, the return defensively, the return of Michael Kendricks was big. He still played a limited role.
He was
only in on sub-package downs. It'll be good to get him back in the fold on a full-time basis.
Yeah, but as I said, I think this is a defense that has continued to get better and better and better. And will there be some games maybe they can be exposed in some areas? Absolutely. But I think for the most part now, schematically, the players understand it a lot better. You can clearly see Bill Davis doing more and more things, which means he's comfortable with the players, and the players are comfortable with what they're being asked to do.
Looking ahead here to the Houston Texans, a team that obviously last year they won 2 games in the year.
Their first two, and they lost their final 14.
That's right. So they
they're 4-4.
They're 4-4 right now. They're competing for one of those last spots in the AFC playoff picture. offensively run-based team. It goes through Arian Foster in that run game. There are most, for the most part, a one-back offense, a lot of 11, 12 personnel, and it's the zone run game. Whether it's outside zone, which is their staple, you know, some inside zone sprinkled in there as well, but it's the zone run game for those guys.
Yeah, and Foster is as good a zone runner as there is in the league. He's deceptively quick. He's deceptively powerful. He's a strider. You know, he's not a burner, but he's got great short area burst, and he has a great feel for when to cut back. And the zone run game, basically, if you reduce it to simplest terms, what you try to do in the blocking scheme is stretch the front side, stretch the side that Foster is going, and cut or seal the backside. And somewhere along the line, that provides a gap. And he has great patience, great vision, and then that burst. And what's critical here for the Eagles is backside contain. You cannot have the backside players away from the front side of the run cross the formation too hard, because he cannot get outside of you. You have those backside players have to pursue, but keep him in front of them, not let him get behind them and outside of them.
You have to sustain that gap integrity.
Yep.
And it, you know, it's
and penetrate. The other thing,
absolutely.
One thing about, just to make a real quick point, one mistake a lot of teams make is they skate laterally to play zone runs. You can't skate laterally. You've got to penetrate upfield.
You've got to press the line of scrimmage if you're one of those second level defenders. Chip Kelly talks about it all the time in the Kelly's Trader segment that we do each and every week. You got to create that wall on the front side and then help collapse the backside. And really look against the teams that run those outside zone stretch plays, Washington, Arizona, New York tried it a couple times. Some of these other teams that we've gone up against
have done a good job.
Really good job against the zone stretch, against those stretch concepts. So I think that, honestly, I think that's the number one, games within the game.
Yep.
That's the number one for me this week.
Because if you get this Texans team into second and longs and third and longs, and yes, Fitzpatrick is a veteran who, amazingly enough, people might not know has started over 80 NFL games now in his career. He's a veteran. He actually has a better arm than people might think. Does tend to force some balls here and there. I think he's susceptible to pressure. You know, he can make a play with his legs once in a while, but I think if they get Houston into second and longs and third and longs, you're going to see pressure.
Yeah, and Ryan Fitzpatrick, we actually talked about it on the Eagles Insider podcast earlier today. He's 1-0-1 against the Eagles. He led them against a win against the Buffalo Bills in 2011, and then he was the opposite quarterback in that famous tie with the Cincinnati Bengals a few years back as well.
I remember that.
So Ryan Fitzpatrick has a good record with against the Eagles so far. But really, I mean, look, that battle in the trenches, stopping the Houston run game is going to be big for them. Defensively, they got Jadeveon Clowney back this week, the number one overall pick. And look, I mean, the guy's incredibly talented, but J.J. Watt, having him on the opposite side, it's a big thing for their front seven.
Yeah, Clowney this week played about 30 snaps, only in the sub packages. Didn't really look as good as I'm sure he will look as he gets better and gets more reps. But obviously, he's someone you have to be aware of. And Watt, we don't need to spend a lot of time on Watt. Everybody knows what he is. But one thing people need to be aware of, in their sub packages, he plays a ton of defensive end now. He doesn't just line up inside. He lines up in a number of different positions, and they may look to match him up on Matt Tobin. They may look to match him up on Mulk inside. They will find someone that they believe he can handle.
Pat Shurmur talked about it in his press conference today, actually. We're filming this Tuesday night. And that, obviously, he's a big part of that scheme, but he's also given the ability to kind of freelance as well along the defensive line. I was really surprised by how much he has moved around. Just watching them in the past, I didn't see that. Now you're seeing him move around all these different spots, over guard, over center, and outside, as a wide technique.
Can you believe that when he came out, there were some people who said he wouldn't be great because he couldn't rush the quarterback?
His story is just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. He'd be a great athlete if he was 230 pounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's 285 pounds?
295 pounds. It's just seeing him, get that pick six against the Colts. He's had multiple opportunities for other ones as well.
You almost had one this week.
Yeah, he did. I saw it. He's just an incredible player. Just an incredible player. Just looking around the rest of that defense, though, I mean, you get to the second level. Obviously, they've had some injuries at linebacker, and they've kind of been rotating some of those players in and out, whether it's the Justin Tuggles or Akeem Dent, who they traded for.
Yep, started last week.
That's right. He started for Cushing.
First start.
Yep, and Mike Muhammad is getting a lot of reps for them inside as well. They're rotating some of these guys in and out.
And they play dime. This is the second week in a row that the Eagles will face a team whose sub package is predominantly dime. They bring DJ Swearinger down essentially as a linebacker in the Dion Buchanan role, as we just saw. And they and Danielle Manning still around.
Yep.
I think if you can pass protect, I think you can get to the secondary. I think their safeties are beatable. Kendrick Lewis, whether it's Swearinger, whether it's Manning, I think if you can protect, you can get to their safeties. Even their corners, A.J. Bouye plays on the outside now in their dime. They bring Kareem Jackson inside over the slot. Yep. So this is a secondary, as I said, that if you can protect and Foles can be strong in the pocket, you can get to this secondary.
Yeah, no question. You brought up the comparison, obviously, with Dion Buchanan and DJ Swearinger.
Buchanan's a better player, no question about it.
I mean, Swearinger has had his ups and downs.
Very much so. I thought he'd be better at this point. He can have moments where he's very good, but Buchanan's a better player,
especially in this role, because coming out of South Carolina, you kind of thought that this would, like very much like Buchanan,
right?
You thought that this would be his role, where close to the line of scrimmage, can play some man, but mostly moving forward and attacking the ball, and he has struggled to say the least.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting. I think, again, another week where they might look to throw the ball a little bit, because I think they'll feel that that's the part of the Texans' defense they can best attack.
Yeah, 28th in the league against the pass, 270-some-odd yards against per game. So that'll be one of the interesting matchups to watch. On the other side of the ball against the Titans this week, you got to see a guy we both of us liked coming out of school, Zach Mettenberger, getting his first start. What was your first take watching Mettenberger play?
Totally expected the performance he gave, which was very up and down. I thought that for a pocket quarterback, there's two things that he did that I would have absolutely expected before I even saw the tape. Number one, he was a beat slow with everything he saw. And number two, he was a beat slow in eliminating what was not there. So he forced a number of balls. I thought, though, he got more comfortable as the game went on. He has a certain demeanor, which I like, which he seems to play every play as a separate play without worrying about what happened before, good or bad. I think that I'll be anxious to see as he continues playing how he deals with pressure, because he's not the kind of guy that's going to deal with pressure with light feet.
Right.
He's the kind of guy that's going to have to deal with pressure by being oblivious to it and making throws with the people around him, which he showed some of that this week. But again, very typical of a rookie quarterback in his first start who's a pure pocket passer, just a beat slow with everything he did.
Yeah, the interception that he threw to Swearinger, actually, the ball just came out a little bit late. And I
think there was actually a linebacker right in the way, and he waited. And when you wait like that, normally that's not a good thing. But I know why he didn't throw it in time, because there was a linebacker sitting underneath the throw.
But he made some throws. I mean, there was that one seam ball against quarters coverage
to Kendall Wright.
Yeah, down the middle
of
the field.
And then the deep ball to Nate Washington on the right sideline.
Right. Yeah. He had some nice passes in the game.
And my guess is, he's going to play for them the rest of the year. I don't see why he wouldn't.
Yeah, they want to get a look at him and see what they've got before they get to the offseason. Just looking around, obviously a big performance from Ben Roethlisberger.
Oh, my
Pittsburgh,
God.
Six touchdown passes and just one of his best games of his career.
It could have been the best game. I know a lot of people always look at Ben Roethlisberger and they immediately think of the play extension and the big body. He's like a big oak tree. Other than the 47-yard touchdown he threw to Antonio Brown, because I went through the tape, I don't think there was a play in this game that wasn't in timing and rhythm. And he was throwing the ball with better anticipation than I've ever seen him throw it. He made some throws before receivers came out of their breaks. And see, it's funny because the Colts don't have a great pass rush, and a lot of people would probably look at that game and say, oh, the Colts don't have a good pass rush. It was 7-on-7. But see, when you throw with great timing and anticipation, you defeat any kind of pressure because the ball is out. And this was the best I've ever seen him. And again, I can't remember every single game he's played, although I've probably seen 90% of them on film. But I can't remember a game in which he played like that for four quarters.
And for a quarterback who really has kind of made a living off of breaking plays and making plays outside the pocket, it's got to be pretty impressive to see.
It was very impressive. And it was noticeable right away. I mean, he was in the zone literally from the first throw.
Did you get a chance to watch Seattle against Carolina?
I did.
What was your thinking? Obviously, you're a week removed now from the Percy Harvin trade, so they've had time to kind of game plan, and if they're going to make any changes, you would assume that they've made them. Have they looked any different?
Well, you didn't see the Jets sweep this week.
Yeah.
But for the most part, I thought it was somewhat similar. They did get under center, I think, a bit more and try to run the ball with very moderate success. They did have a beautiful delayed draw with Lynch for 25 yards, a play they don't run a lot of, and I think they caught Carolina. Wilson had a very good final drive, but he was not sharp through much of the game, missed a number of throws. In fact, he had a run. You know, it's funny how this works. Carolina did something that I'm in favor of. You know, it's easy to sit here with a clicker, of course, as you know, and we're all real smart watching plays 10 times and figuring it out. But Carolina did something that against a lot of these option quarterback, read option quarterbacks, I happen to be in favor of tactically, is they took away Wilson's running. They always kept a defender. That outside defender always played Wilson. So they forced him to hand it off.
Right.
So they took away the option. Now, sometimes Lynch would run for 4 or 5 yards, and they live with it. But they took away the option.
Well, when you've got those guys inside, when you've got Luke Kuechly and Star Latulule and all those guys they've got inside, it kind of makes it easy. It's a good game plan.
Yeah, and I always wonder why more teams don't take away the option, because the whole point of that for the offense is to have the option. Take away the option and make the quarterback hand the ball off.
Yeah, it's a really good point. Lastly, last team I wanted to ask you about, and this game happened last night, so I'm not sure if you got to watch much
I didn't
of
get
it.
To see the tape yet.
It was interesting to see.
But I watched the game until overtime, and then I just, my eyes didn't allow me to see the overtime.
We've only got so much left in us.
Right, right.
This is one of the times that we've gotten to see Dallas get away from that formula.
A little bit.
And it was interesting to see how they responded to adversity. And obviously, look, the change in formula didn't work for them.
Yeah, and again, it's hard to get a true read because Romo came out. But the thing that stood out to me last night, and they play Arizona this week, was how much Jim Haslett went with blitz, zero blitz with Romo in the game.
Yeah.
I think Romo missed a few things in the game as far as blitz recognition and understanding when to get rid of the football. And believe me, I guarantee Todd Bowles is probably doing some salivating this week. I bet Arizona will do a little blitzing.
Yeah, I would imagine so. But I think that'll do it, Greg. I think
another good one, Fran.
Another good one. Appreciate the time as always. Let's get to my interview with NFL Draft Insider Tony Pauline from DraftInsider.net. Joining us now in what seems like it's been a long time, but it actually has only been a couple weeks, longtime NFL Draft Analyst from DraftInsider.net, our good friend Tony Pauline. Tony, welcome back to the show, man.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me again.
No, absolutely. And you've been putting out a lot of great stuff over the last couple weeks, particularly talking about underclassmen that may or may not declare for the draft. And I wanted to first start this off with one quote that you tweeted recently over the last couple of days. And that was from a league insider that you talked to who said, if I have the draft's first pick and I don't need a quarterback, I'm taking Randy Gregory from Nebraska, the defensive end, linebacker, pass rusher. You said in an article last week that it was about 99% that he was going to declare. What's the deal with Randy Gregory?
Yeah, not only did I say it was 99% that he was going to declare, I also said that area scouts were talking him as top five material, which I think led more credence and validity to what I heard yesterday. The fact that, he's gone from top five guys to teams are saying, or there are people saying, if I don't need a quarterback, I'm looking at Randy Gregory. He's got a lot of momentum going for him. People look at him as a freakish athlete. They say he's just a smaller version of Jadeveon Clowney, a guy who can make plays up the field, very athletic, probably can use him in zone blitzes more effectively than you can with Jadeveon Clowney. We saw this building. You saw last year as a sophomore, Gregory just causing a lot of impact out of junior college, and I think scouts think that, number one, he's taken his game to the next level, plus there's a tremendous amount of upside potential there with his game.
Are there any worries with Gregory in terms of, obviously, his experience at the Division I level? This is only his second year as a starter, and then he also is coming off, he had a little bit of a knee issue in the beginning of the year. Are any of these things type of red flags that will pop up in the spring?
I'm going to say no, because you know what? I'm one of those guys who like to see a body of work, and there really isn't that much there for Gregory. But you look at guys like Cam Newton, other players who are, one-year wonders or really basically had their draft stock based off of 1 year in college football. that won't be a problem for Gregory because he was good last year. He's better this year and really hasn't shown a lot of ill effects from that knee injury during the 2014 campaign.
Another pass rusher that you brought up in that article talking about the underclassmen that made declare, Tony, Georgia linebacker Leonard Floyd, a true sophomore. And it's not often that you see these true sophomores declare, but he's a special case.
Yeah, the Larry Fitzgerald rule. Basically, he's 3 years removed from high school. Remember, the rule is you have to be 3 years removed from high school. Floyd spent a year after graduating from high school in prep school, then has spent two seasons, or this is his second season at University of Georgia. So he fits that Larry Fitzgerald rule, 3 years removed from high school. He was very good last year. He's an impact type of guy, maybe a one-gap defensive end, 3-4 outside linebacker. He gets a lot of pressure up the field. The type of player that if you watch Georgia play on Saturdays, usually they're putting two guys on him. They shade the fullback over to his side because he is such a disruptive force up the field. You know, sort of like Gregory in the sense that he's getting better and he's got a lot of upside to his game.
You also listed one of his teammates, another linebacker I know you're high on, Jordan Jenkins, as a possibility as well.
Yeah, I hear a very, very distinct possibility, about 90% right now, that he's going to enter the draft. He is just a forceful guy if you watch him. They usually use him in space, and he's very effective. He can play sideline to sideline, easily gets outside the numbers to the flanks in pursuit, can drop in the coverage, but he's also good up the field. If you use him on run blitzes, use him to stack against the run, you use him to blitz, very understated. I mean, that linebacker crew that they have at Georgia is talented in the underclassmen and senior ranks. Jenkins doesn't have all the great stats as some of the other guys, the high tackle numbers, but when you watch him on film, he's just very explosive, very sudden, comes out of nowhere basically to blow up plays.
Another guy, and this is the last junior I wanted to ask you about, Michigan offensive weapon, really, Devin Funchess. Last year he was listed as a tight end. This year he's listed as a receiver. Obviously he's going to be a pass-catching weapon at the next level, but do you think scouts see him more as a wide receiver or more as still as one of those new-age tight ends?
No, I think he's definitely a tight end. He's too big for a receiver. He doesn't have that great receiver quickness to separate the next level that you want. I think that Michigan just moved him out to wide receiver to basically create some mismatches. You know, maybe give Derek Gardner a better receiver, a better pass-catching target down the field. Hasn't worked out in a variety of ways for the team, for the offense, for Gardner himself. But I think, hands down, Funchess, you look at his size, you look at his playing style, he's definitely a tight end at the next level. I'd be shocked if anyone, you know, maybe they use him split out wide on occasion. But for the most part, he's going to be drafted as a tight end.
One of the things that's been kind of one of the unfortunate narratives over the last couple of years has been the rise in the amount of underclassmen I've declared. I would hope that given the trend that we saw last year and the year before with so many of these guys get underdrafted or go undrafted, do you think some of these guys will choose to stay in school this year, or do you think that number is going to continue to be in the almost triple digits?
Well, I think the latter. I think you're still going to have a lot of underclassmen because what happened is, you know, the CBA, they thought that maybe some of these underclassmen would stay in. There was going to be a hard cap number on what the rookies coming into the league would receive. There would be no more huge contracts. And there wouldn't be a great disparity between being, say, a mid-first-round pick, a late first-round pick, a mid-second-round pick, or even a difference between a mid-second-round pick and a mid-third-round pick. But what it's done, it's had the opposite effect because kids are saying, you know what, if I'm a late third-round pick now and I improve my draft stock and I go back and I'm going to be a mid-second-round choice a year later, I haven't really made that much more money as opposed to getting my pro career started now and getting to that second contract 3 years from now. Because that second contract is really the one where you're going to make major money in the NFL. So the thought process is, you know what, if I've got to take less money now entering the draft and becoming a third, fourth, or even a fifth-round pick, or even undrafted, but I can play the next 3 years and get to that second contract quicker, that's where I'm going to make my major bucks. So I think the CBA, in the end, has had an opposite effect in pulling the underclassmen out because in a lot of ways, it doesn't pay for a lot, or a lot of these guys feel it doesn't pay for them to stay because there were no more huge contracts, especially at the top of the draft.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see, and it's unfortunate because a lot of those juniors, I mentioned some of them went undrafted last year. Some of those guys didn't even make it to training camp with certain teams. So it'll be a really interesting trend to follow as we move through the 2014 offseason and into 2015 is how many of those guys come out, how many of them end up sticking, and how that impacts the draft process moving forward. But enough with the juniors. I really wanted to transition to the senior class, and one guy in particular – Colorado State left tackle Tyler Sombrello. I watched this kid versus Boston College, Tony. He's a big athletic kid, locates defenders at the second level, can locate and strike in space. Really impressive guy, finishes blocks. But you're hearing pretty conflicting things. Some scouts are high on him and some aren't. What's the deal?
That's basically is the deal. And like you said, he's athletic. If you got to watch any of the game against Wyoming, the Colorado State-Wyoming game, he actually caught a pass in that game. They sent him out in a pattern, caught a pass, which was called back because of a penalty. I think teams kind of see him as a tweener. They think he's too big and a little too stiff and doesn't have the natural foot quickness to play a left tackle, and they don't know that he's strong enough to play right tackle.
All right, so one final guy I wanted to ask you about, Tony. You put out your Risers and Sliders article earlier this week, and one of your sleepers, and I want to give a nod here to our producer, Brian Thomas. He's been harping about this guy for the last couple weeks to me every time, you know, he watches college football on Saturdays just like the rest of us. Arkansas tight end A.J. Derby, former quarterback, turned tight end, had a big catch for a touchdown against Alabama a couple weeks ago. Reminds you of an interesting former quarterback turned tight end that played in the NFL for a long time. What have you seen from Derby?
Yeah, that would be Jay Reimers, the same type of player. You know, a guy who he doesn't really come across as a dynamic athlete, but he's smart. He sees the field. He knows how to get open. He knows how to find those soft spots in the defense down the field. Doesn't have a lot of catches, but he's got a 15.5-yard average per catch. You know that the coach in Arkansas, when he was at Wisconsin, produced a lot of very good tight ends. So I think there's a chance that Derby maybe gets a Senior Bowl invite or an invite to one of the postseason games because it's not a very strong tight end class. Maybe he sneaks into the combine, sneaks into those late rounds. You're looking at a guy like Reimersma, Jay Reimersma from Michigan, who's going to be a late-round pick, but as he develops over time at his new position, really can impact in the NFL, if not as a number one receiver, but as a number two receiver who has to learn how to block but has got some natural pass-catching skills.
Tony Pauline, thanks as always for joining us here on the show. You're a great contributor to the site as all season long, particularly obviously in the spring as we prepare for the NFL draft. You can follow Tony on Twitter at Tony Pauline and check out all of his great content at draftinsider.net. Tony, thanks very much for joining us once again on the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast.
No problem. Have a good day.
All right, that's going to do it, I think, for another week of the Eagle Eye in the Sky podcast. Thanks again to NFL Films senior producer Greg Cosell for joining me in the studio. And another big thanks to Tony Pauline from draftinsider.net for talking some college football. We'll be back next week after the Eagles' huge game against the Houston Texans.